Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us once again for what is hopefully going to be a very, very exciting webinar on moving to Portugal and obtaining residency here. Sandra is back once again to answer all of our budding legal questions, and I'm very, very happy to have her here. Last week, we spoke about Portuguese citizenship, and we got through a lot of questions. It was very, very interesting. I thought I knew a little bit about it. I realized I did not. It was great to get all of that information. I know from the comments, people said it was really, really helpful. Today we're going to be talking about moving to Portugal and obtaining residency. And for those whose final goal is citizenship, that is, you know, one of the big steps in the process, but it's also a step towards moving to Portugal and creating a new life for yourself. We're going to talk about a few of the different visas, such as the D7 and the D8 or digital nomad visa. And we're going to talk about some of the documentation required and some of the steps that you need to take. Sandra is no stranger here. She's been on several webinars before, but for those who haven't come across her before, I'm very keen for you to introduce yourself, Sandra, and tell me and everyone listening a little bit about yourself and what SGP does.
Okay, thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure for me to be here, as I have mentioned repeatedly also. We do appreciate, we do like you. It's not only me, but my team does like you and what you do, James. So it's a very happy collaboration that we have because we actually share common values. I'm a lawyer in Portugal for 30 years. I have been working nonstop as a lawyer. I did from day one. I always worked with foreigners and foreign investment, which back then, 30 years ago, it was not the norm. I worked with important foreign investments, such as the enlargement of the bridge 25 de Abril and the introduction of a train there, which is was also they had this plan also for from San Francisco and from the original plan, but just implemented in the 90s. I have extensive experience in litigation and arbitration, and during some time I was also responsible for a legal department of a big company that had intense litigation in respect to competition, labor law, other aspects. So the truth is, as I've been working nonstop, I do know the systems, we do know the people, and if anything complicated arises and different and new, I think we are able to figure out a strategy, a legal an effective legal strategy, and we are able to deal with this matter. I was a partner of a big firm for 17 years. I often do lectures and present conferences about arbitration, litigation, investment in Portugal, visas, tax benefits in Portugal, and as I previously mentioned, I also lecture in Heidelberg, which is one of the top law universities in the world. These last 7 years, we have focused a lot on helping foreigners moving to Portugal. This is one of the big departments of our firm. And our aim and our goal is to make sure that from a legal point of view, there's nothing wrong and everything we meet every little dot, which is complicated because, as I have mentioned also repeatedly, we live in a country of unstandardized bureaucracy and of discretionary powers. So it can always be challenging to be accurate and to be correct and to provide the client. We are every day we learn something new. Every day we have a little surprise. So it's a ongoing learning process, which I personally like. So, and at the office, I think also what differentiates us, besides a very good legal preparation, is that we do like people. We do like to talk with people. We do like to assist, to be of service. We have as a goal to make the relocation process smoother. And at this time, we understand where the problems are. and we understand how the relocation can be better from a legal point of view, and from also we have a relocation team here, and also from a relocation point of view itself.
Okay, thank you so much, Sandra. And before we get on to the next bit, I just want to let everyone know that we have a Q&A section at the bottom of the Zoom panel, which you can click. And if you have any specific questions for Sandra and her team, you can ask it there, and it may even get answered before the webinar is out. So we'll be going through most of the questions that were asked before the webinar, but if you have any, you can ask it there. Now, Sandra, I do have some questions for you about SGP and what your firm does. So can you tell me a little bit about, if let's say that I was looking to move to Portugal, I'm living in outside of the EU, let's say I'm living in the United Kingdom, and I'm looking at the D7 or the D8 visa, and I'm wondering, should I work with you to help me move there? How could you help me?
Yes, that's your decision. You have to make your decision by yourself, according to our bar. It's up to you to know us and to see if we match with your criteria and your ideals and the way things should be done. Our first objective is to have everything from a legal point of view in place and correct. The first steps would be to create a tax number. And we normally don't only create a tax number, but we also give an overview of the tax system, because I think just to give this a tax number, maybe not, it's not enough for a foreigner that wants to move here. They do need to understand how the tax authority platform works and to have an overview of the system and of the basic obligations a foreigner might have here in Portugal. Then, as we set up a bank account, because as everybody know by now, most people, it is also mandatory to have a Portuguese bank account prior to initiating the visa process in your country of citizenship or legal residency. Normally with the banks, we try to get, there are some voices saying that we might have a crisis, that we do have an Ukrainian war that was not good for the banking system and for the European economy and also for the worldwide economy. And so taking into account also this situation, we also try to work with the bank that at a given moment has the best rating in Portugal and so the least risk of insolvency. Most foreigners don't pay attention to this, but I believe this is quite important, because the only amount that is secure is something like 50,000 euros. And so if there is an insolvency of a bank, which we don't expect, but might happen, people might lose some money, and that might not be the best solution. Okay. Might not be a good thing, obviously. So do you want me to continue?
Yes, please. So it's a personalized service then.
Yes. Then we try to have several personal meetings with the client.
Okay.
We do everything that we can do on our end in respect to the visa. So we will fill in the forms, we get the appointment in the consulate, we prepare everything that we can do on our side, and we guide the client throughout the process, through each detail. First, we send an email with everything very detailed, and then we set up several Zoom meetings with a client to explain everything, so the client always feel guided, always feel that he has someone that partners him in the process, and that there is no, we try to avoid as much as possible any error or any omission of any important stuff. So we do check, double check, triple check the documents. Sometimes, as a disclaimer, I say we did even ask a little bit more than what some places required, because we want to make sure that the process is bulletproof and that there will be no problems. The client won't have any type of problem with the visa. So we set up several personal Zoom meetings. So we are the Our process is very personalized. So it's just the antithesis of something that's just online and you don't meet people. We do know our clients. We try to address their problems. And so it's very personalized. And we set up the Zoom meetings that the client needs to understand the process or to clarify any question that he might have or any doubt that he might have in respect to the process. So by the time the clients get to the consulate appointment, he should have a very organized file that was checked, double checked, triple checked, to avoid to avoid the risk of having a denied application.
Okay. Now, I understand there's two appointments that people need to attend, one in their home country with the consulate, and the other one in Portugal with IMA, which is Seth before. Do you help with either of those appointments?
Yes, of course. Normally, if the client would ask, we could be under a certain fee, we could go to the consulate to the US or also their home country if they do want this kind of service. But normally, it's not necessary. And when the client goes to the consulate, he will probably leave the passport in the consulate, or if this is also possible, he may ask the consulate then to go there when they are in the conditions to stamp their passport. And then when the consulate stamps the passport from the client, they normally give a date for the IMA appointment, which is normally within 4 months within the time of the visa, meaning within 4 months, the four following months.
Okay.
Sometimes the consulate doesn't give an appointment for IMA, and this might be tricky because we then have an ongoing personnel calling IMA to get the appointments, which it's not an easy task.
No.
And then we always go to the client, with the client to the IMA appointment. For the IMA, we have to fill in specific forms. We have to update some documents. And sometimes, although the law says that the IMA appointment should be at a location that you presented as your residency in Portugal, sometimes they don't have vacancies. So we have clients that will have appointments in Lagoa, in Bragança, in Porto, sometimes the same family in different places. But we always, someone very experienced from my team goes with the person, so they feel together. And it's not abnormal that sometimes they might face someone that is not proficient in English, or that might raise additional things or additional documentation that the person was not expecting. I had recently a D8 client. We went with him to Coimbra, it was the 2nd of January. And then we got there and the services were closed. And they didn't get another appointment for the 3rd of January. It was not possible to get an appointment for the next day. But it was good that we went, because the client would not have been notified that there was an appointment on the 6th if we had not gone there and we had not asked. And then it was a D8, and they did ask that we have the proof, the declaration, the contract, the transferences, everything. It was the transfers, everything. But then they asked, the client had everything set up himself, but then they asked for the payslips, and we also had them. So there is always a little novelty and a little thing. And also, up to now, it was considered that it was enough by the IMA appointment to have the travel insurance. One of the ladies in this IMA said that it was the travel insurance was not enough. But then when I asked her to say why, she didn't say anything, and she didn't, and the process was okay. But there is always a little, and this client was extremely organized. He had the file that he presented in Canada, and in Canada they are very demanding, much more demanding than most countries. It's even they only accept that people set up appointments personally in that place, in that specific place. Yes, always learning, always novelties to make sure everything is all right. We, in this process, we also may help the client. As you know, one of the common requirements of the residency visa is a proof of accommodation. So we may help the client to find the apartment, taking into account people that firms that collaborate with us, and taking into account the criteria of the client and their budget. And we also do a legal due diligence in respect to the documentation of the apartment. As you know, we have a land registry that has a sort of an ID of the properties. So it is possible to know if there's any big problem with this property or apartment. If there is any litigation, it should be to be enforceable against third parties. It should be registered in the land registry. So we do check these things. It's also important to regulate the lease contract properly. You don't want the landlord to have the possibility to visit the house whenever he wants. You want to make sure that it's clear what is the condition and status of the house when you enter it. You want, if any dispute arises from this contract, you want to establish a mechanism that could expedite somehow the process. It might be a nightmare to litigate in Portugal just before of how long it takes. And so these in general terms would be the basic that we do for our clients.
Okay. It sounds, would you say that someone applying for, say, the D7 or D8 in Canada could be asked for different documents to, say, someone in the US or UK or somewhere?
Yes.
Not specifically.
And they are more demanding, and the process of also setting the appointment is different. There is a place that they only accept, that used to accept appointments in the beginning of a month. Now, as you probably know, the Canada entered the Convention of Hague, and now the apostille was implemented in Portugal, in Canada. And something that was clear, that people could present a sealed FBI background check. Now in Canada, in one case, they didn't accept. They wanted it to be apostilled, which was something that we all that work in this industry know that we would accept that in the States, a sealed envelope of a FBI background check is commonly accepted. So there are always little surprises that we have. And also, for instance, the return ticket, which we were thinking not to ask the clients to buy. But we had just a recent case in Canada where they did ask for the ticket. So we want to make sure that it's better for the person. It is in the list, so it's better for them to have the ticket. So it's always learning, always trying to not demand too much of the client, but we prefer to demand more and make sure that there are no big risks for our client.
It sounds like you and your team have an encyclopedic knowledge of all the different consulates, what they want, the people working there, what they want.
Yes, but there is always novelty, because in the States, we just have some new consulates. So with new practices and new people, so it is always, it can always be challenging. And it's always learning and always updating our files and our lists and our way of doing things to make sure everything is perfect for the client.
Okay, well, that is really, really interesting to know. And I think we could start into some of the questions from before. We've covered quite a few of them actually in that section, so thank you so much for that. One question that came up quite a few times is, What are the sort of physical stay requirements for each visa?
So all the residency visas, the D7, the D8, require you to reside in Portugal, to have your home in Portugal. And according to the law, within a 2-year period, and this is only checked upon renewal. And within a 2-year period, you should not leave the country for more than 6 months in a row or 8 months total. But we have understood that the authorities have not been very strict in this regard, and they just want to make sure that Portugal is your home, that your family life is based here. This has been the main criteria, and they have not been very strict in terms of mandatory times of stay until now, but we don't know what might happen in the future.
Okay, that's interesting. And
I would like to add something that we are learning about IMA. Initially, we thought that IMA was basically, they changed the name, and we thought the process was, we were not noticing great changes in the process because physically the places were the same. So, and the personnel was the same. So we were not understanding what innovations IMA had. But now we are understanding that IMA in the consulates, IMA is having an early intervention that we didn't notice before with SEF.
Okay.
So IMA already makes some remarks and some comments sometimes in respect to the visa application. And it's also important to know, and for that, I think it's important also knowledge of administrative law that's applicable to immigration laws, since this is a part of public law, that whenever the authorities create an act that might jeopardize your situation somehow, that might be prejudicial to yourself, you are always entitled, according to the Portuguese Constitution, to provide allegations and to present your arguments. So we had a case of a D8 where the client didn't have a formal labor contract. And in the States, it's not mandatory, as it is not in Portugal, to have a written contract, to have a labor contract. Our rules in terms of formalities of the contract is, if written form, it's not mandatory. It's, you are not obliged to have legal form to have a valid contract. And it's the same in the States in respect of a labor contract. So, but it's important to understand these details, because if you don't, and if you don't know how to react properly in terms of administrative law, there might be a huge problem because you don't know how to react and how to approach any problem that might arise.
Okay. Thank you. I noticed a few questions coming in about IMA and what does it stand for? And I guess we should explain that it's AIMA rather than IMA. And Sandra, are you able to say what it stands for?
I think, I don't know the acronym exactly, but I think it's an immigration agency, something like that.
Okay.
Previous said, it's our immigration services are provided for with IMA. I can check on my phone and see exactly what it means.
We'll let you check that then.
Let me see. Now it's I'm a, then it only appeared Seth. Let me check. Agency for Integration of Migration and Asylum.
Okay.
That is the literal translation. I hope it's, yes.
Yes, that's very helpful.
It is our immigration services. It was exactly what the previous SEF used to stand for.
And then we've mentioned the D7 and D8. I guess maybe you could just give a sort of a 1-minute overview of what those are before we go into more detail, because I think there's some people don't know.
Okay. The D7 is a residency visa, as the D8 is also a residency visa. So both are visas that require you to reside, to have your home in Portugal, even if you don't have very strict times to stay in Portugal. Although the authorities are not super, super strict analyzing the mandatory time to stay here. The D7 is for those who have passive income. Passive income is income that you don't have to work for, such as pension, royalties, interests, rentals. These are considered passive income. So people that have passive income can apply to a D7. Okay. And in this case, the financial requirement is on average that you earn a Portuguese minimum wage, which is at this point 820 euros per month. This is a D7. The D8 is the well-known digital nomad visa. Although I must note that this is not limited to digital activities or tech activities. This can be applicable to all those working remotely in Portugal for a foreign entity, irrespective of the form of this professional relationship. You can be an independent worker, you can be an employee, you can be all sorts of professional arrangements or professional contracts can enter into this category. So it's irrespective of the nature of the professional contract you have, if you are being paid by a foreign entity and living remotely in Portugal, you can apply for the D8 or digital nomad visa. In this case, you have to show in terms of financial means that on average you earn 4 Portuguese minimum wages per month, which is at this point, if I'm not mistaken, 3,280 euros per month that you have to show in the 3 months prior to initiating the application for a D8. These two visas, in general terms, they have a common regime. So in terms of time to stay, in terms of obligations, in terms they have a common regime. In terms of the right to have civil residency in Portugal, other than the requirements, these different requirements, they have a common regime. And for both these visas, you have to have a tax number in Portugal prior to initiating the application, a bank account in Portugal prior to initiating the application, a proof of accommodation prior to initiating the application. You can buy a house, you can lease a home. These are common in both visas.
Okay, so there's a lot of commonality between
yes.
the two of them.
Yes.
Let's see. And then you've mentioned on the D8 about, I think maybe on the D7 too, but on the D8 about income coming from outside of Portugal. Do you
yes.
mean that basically you couldn't get paid by a company in Portugal and qualify for it? You would have to get paid by a company not in Portugal.
Yes, yes. This is working remotely. If you would be working for a Portuguese company, then there are other routes.
Okay.
But not to the D8.
And for both of those visas, I understand you start the process outside of Portugal in your country of residence. Are there any visas where you start the process in Portugal?
The D8, in theory, you can start in Portugal.
Okay.
From a practical point of view, is not working. It's not
okay.
working. We don't advise that. But you D8, you can start in Portugal. The D7, no.
Okay.
And there are other visas, and there are the manifestation of interest that can start in Portugal. But it's taking a long, long time. So we don't advise clients to do this.
And when people are applying for either of these visas or other visas, what are some of the biggest sort of legal mistakes you've seen people make when they do it themselves?
They don't know sometimes in terms of proof of accommodation. They don't know what has to be notarized and what has to be apostilled. They don't know sometimes to draft properly the personal statement. Sometimes they don't meet the financial requirements, and they don't know that they don't meet the financial requirements. But what has happened, clients have told that some friends and some acquaintances had really horror stories in terms of the process itself.
Okay. So that gets us through some of our first general questions. One thing I did want to touch on as well was the NHR regime. It's something we haven't really brought up yet, but it sort of came to an end last year, and there is a new regime in. And being honest, I don't think we know a lot about it. So I'm hoping you can shed a little light.
I to be completely honest, me neither, because we have to wait for the regulation of the new regime and how it will be applied from a practical point of view. I will give a super brief overview of the NHR, the non-habitual tax regime. It was something that was created in 2009. And if I'm not mistaken, entered into force in something like 2011. And this regime was fantastic for retirees. Initially, in an initial phase, people normally to international, according to international tax law, people should pay taxes in respect to their pension where they reside. And Portugal initially exempted people totally from paying taxes in respect to their pension for a 10-year period. And this was huge, particularly for French or for North Europeans, where they pay something like 40 or 50% of taxes in their homeland, and then they could come to Portugal and don't pay taxes in respect to their pension. This regime raised a lot of problems also with Portugal and the European Union. Some countries revoked the conventions to avoid double taxation in Portugal. And this really the situation of the retirees. This was the big advantage of the NHR, which was abolished. So it's not in place, but it could be still applicable for all those that started the visas in 2023. Those can still benefit from the NHR. We don't have for individuals no more an NHR. And there was also another category, but that was not so used and so common as those of the retirees. It was all those that had high value activities that were different, that were limited and changed during time, could benefit for a 20% flat tax rate in respect to income generated in Portugal. In addition to what I said previously, I think it would be important to note that in the last years, the NHR regime changed. And so the government, in respect to the pensions, taxed 10%. If people were not paying already 10% or more in the country that generated this kind of pensions. Then we have this other situation of the high value activities where people could benefit from a flat tax rate of 20% in certain professions in respect to income generated in Portugal. And this regime was for individuals, for individual persons. Now we have a new NHR regime that will be applicable for innovative projects and also scientific research. And those situations, it might be possible to benefit from a 20% flat tax rate. But this new regime will be applicable not for individuals, but for companies. But we can only understand how this will work once you understand how the regulation would be applied. So we don't know this much about this new NHR regime, but I think for those who have tech innovative projects or for those who want to do scientific research in Portugal, and we have lots of German companies that already are doing scientific research in Portugal. So for those, I think this might be an interesting thing to study and to analyze, but we'll have to know more about the regime to give a more deep analysis of what it entails.
It sounds like then your job has two elements. One is sort of reading and understanding the law and the theoretical, and then the other bit is looking at what actually happens in practice.
Because in the end, what interests people, I think it's very important to have a deep theoretical knowledge, because you can react and you can argument and you can act properly, but you have to, people are interested in practical results. So this, I have to think about them. But I in respect to the NHR, there's something very important that I would like to add. I have been speaking with hundreds of Americans and Canadians and British, and British more, they still talk, some of them, to the in respect, they still mention the NHR. But for the Americans, the NHR, they are not moving to Portugal because of the NHR. Portugal is still much more affordable for them. We still have excellent low real estate taxes. So they are not moving. The NHR might be a plus in some cases, but it's important for people, because for some people, the NHR didn't have any impact. So I think for the Americans and the Canadians, many times the NHR was not impactful at all. Another positive aspect the NHR had was for those that had dividends, royalties, rentals generated in their country of origin, this with the NHR would be automatically exempted from paying taxes in Portugal. But the truth is, in many situations, with a convention to avoid double taxation, this exemption still exists. So many people, the fact that we ended the NHR, and I think this is a little bit the subconscious, the NHR will end, we'll have to grab it, otherwise we'll be in hell forever. No, this is not. For many people, it's important to study and to analyze, because for many people, the NHR and the elimination of the NHR will not have a big impact. So it's very important to rationalize and to understand this very well. And also from a tax perspective, and also when you own a home here, yearly you pay less than 1% based on the tax value of the property, which many times is very little.
Okay.
In comparison to the US, in any other European country.
So let's talk a little bit about the D7 then. And considering we were just sort of talking about pensions and pensioners, what are the requirements for the D7?
I think I already mentioned it, but I will repeat it. So you need to have a tax number in Portugal, a bank account in Portugal, and a proof of accommodation in Portugal. But it's common requirements also in respect to the other visas.
Okay.
Other than that, you have to show, also you need to show the criminal record, and you need to show that on average monthly you earn 820 euros on passive income, meaning pensions, rentals, dividends, royalties, meaning passive income is income you don't have to work for. You would not be an active worker, because the D8 is for active workers.
Okay. And when you say criminal records, then is that just in the country where I'm residing now, or is it possible I'd need it from other countries?
You might need it from the country of citizenship in certain places.
So one question that people often ask is they want to know whether they can still do some kind of freelancing or other type of work while on the D7 visa.
Yes, they can.
And then with regards to the rental agreement, is that for 12 months always, or is it possible to have a shorter one?
Some places talk about 6 months.
Okay.
Some consulates talk about 12 months.
So it depends on what the consulate asks for.
But it's always harder to get a 6 months from practical point of view, because normally the landlords don't want to lease for 6 months. They want a 1 year lease. And some places do demand one year lease.
Okay. And then one, people are quite concerned, I think, about having a rental contract, especially if it's in Portuguese, which they don't necessarily speak. Is that something that you can help people with?
Yes, of course. We always have it bilingual,
Okay.
the Portuguese and the English part, so the clients fully understand the terms and the conditions and the clauses of the contract. And we also try to negotiate. We just had an American client that told me that they said they would not do a contract without a grantor. And then we talked with the person in Portuguese, and it's different when you approach the persons in your own language. And she they accepted that she would have to pay some down payment, but she didn't have a grantor. Another client had he really needed the lease for Oporto, and the landlord, it was an old man, and he found it really strange that he wanted the lease without seeing the house, and he was really suspicious. So he sent a friend policeman to our office to be sure that we were real. So this is the kind of help that it's, and it's the conversation with landlords and the negotiation of the clauses and the down payments. It's not easy, and it's not easy for a foreigner. I think it's even for us sometimes it's not easy. So I think it's always important when you have a native person that does understand the system and the legal terms and the clauses and the law to negotiate and to act on your behalf.
Yeah, I agree. I think if I was moving to a new country and I didn't really speak the language, I would assume whatever contract the language gave, the landlord gave me was the standard one and it wasn't negotiable. So it's interesting to know that you can talk about the terms of the contract.
Yes, in terms of civil law in Portugal, when something is not forbidden, you are totally free to negotiate and to stipulate as you please. So it's
Okay.
quite important. And as you probably experience, at this point, litigation in Portugal is a little bit of a nightmare. So it's important also to address the mechanisms, and it's possible to expedite mechanisms for to resolve for dispute resolution. I think this is also very important.
Okay. And with regard to the application itself, once the person has all the documents together, is this something that they do at the consulate or could they do it online?
They get many times the appointment online,
Okay.
but there is always a personal appointment in the consulate. You cannot skip that.
Okay. And I understand in the US, for example, that you might have a consulate in somewhere like California and another one over in, I think, Newark or Washington or somewhere like that. What if you're in the middle of the country or somewhere like that, are you having to travel to one of these other places?
Yes, you
Okay.
have. You have to go to the personal meeting appointments yourself. You have to travel. But now
Okay.
they open some new ones in the US, so people don't have to travel this much, but you'll have to travel.
Okay. So once you have your meeting with the consulate, they issue you a visa for 4 months in which you get to move to Portugal and during that time attend your interview with IMA. What if something happens and you have an emergency and you can't travel within those 4 months? Could you get an extension or something like that?
It's always challenging to talk with IMA and to try
Okay.
to postpone or get another appointment, but of course this can be done.
Okay, so going back to those discretionary powers then.
Yes. And the difficulty to communicate with IMA.
Okay. And one of the things you mentioned before is some consulates, the IMA appointment is given automatically. Sometimes it's not. How does someone get that appointment if it hasn't been given to them automatically?
They can call IMA and try to
Okay.
get an appointment. This is what we do, because sometimes the consulates do give an appointment, sometimes they don't.
And I understand it is a very challenging process to get through. through on those numbers?
Yes, yes. We have several people calling IMA.
Okay.
Every day.
Not an easy job.
And sometimes we are not. Yes, it takes time.
So I have one question here that's very, very specific to the UK. And they're talking about their pension income, and there it's possible when you reach 55 or above to take a 25% of your pension as a lump sum. Would that lump sum be something that you could use towards the D7, as it wouldn't be passively coming in each month?
I believe that in the US there is also something similar.
Okay.
But as you know, normally the consulates do demand that people show regular passive income and not just savings or lump sum. But we do know of cases where savings were accepted and a lump sum was accepted. So I would say you would not be 100% sure with that, but it might be accepted. The solution should be always to discuss and to talk with a consulate.
Okay, so someone could come to you with that situation, and you would be able to get an idea.
Yes,
before
yes,
the application.
We
sure.
will. Yes, of course.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. That's
this
better
is
than
this is an exceptional situation. It's not the ideal situation.
Okay, and one other question that's come up is, a lot of people are aware that it's quite difficult at the moment to get an IMA appointment. Suppose someone moves to Portugal for those 4 months and they don't manage to get one in that time, but they've been trying, or you've been trying on their behalf. What happens then?
I think there is a bona fides principle that's venire contra factum proprio. If the public services, the immigration services, generate this delay because it's not possible to get an appointment, this should not jeopardize the client, but this is a legal principle. So people should be, if there is a delay from IMA, this should not affect the person.
Okay, so it
and
sound
they should
like,
not be considered illegal here.
Okay, that's good to know. It sounds like there are little bits of the law designed to protect people and make up for areas where public services are falling short. One thing we discussed on the citizenship webinar was the fact that it can take a long time to get your application processed in some stages. So citizenship was being granted, if I get this correctly, or the clock starts ticking towards citizenship when you submit your application, assuming it's successful. Maybe you can explain that better.
Yes, yes. So before the 5 years for residency, which is one of the big advantages of Portugal. So within 5 years of residing here, you can access an European passport with the civil rights of an European citizen, which is huge. You can live, work in any European country. So this is huge. So, but the 5 years would start to count from the day you receive the resident permit card. And with the new law, what the law says, it is that the 5 years would start counting from the day you initiate the application. And this is very good, not only because of the time, but I think also shows that the Portuguese government wants sometimes also to fight the delays and to respond to the delays, which for all those that work in this industry is quite important.
Yes, absolutely. And going back to that 820 euros per month figure for the D7, let's suppose that someone had a spouse or a partner and a child as well. Would they need 3 times 820, or is there an exception given there?
No, it's plus 50% of this amount for the spouse in,
okay.
and for plus 30% for each child.
Okay, good to
so
know.
50% of 820 if you're bringing your spouse under your own visa, because she also may have an independent visa.
Okay.
And plus 30% of this amount monthly if you're bringing any children under your own visa.
Okay. Now the DAs, which we're going to move on to, that has a much higher amount, is that correct?
Yes, it's four times the Portuguese minimum wage, which is 3,280 euros per month, that you have to show in the 3 months prior to initiating the application.
Okay, and there's another visa out there called the D2, which is for people who want to do business in Portugal, and it has a lower amount of, I think, 820 as well.
Yes.
Someone just apply for that if they were sort of a freelancer or a business type person instead of the D8?
They might, but it's more challenging because they do have to have a business plan. They do have to have capital invested, and it would have to be approved by the Portuguese authority. So from a legal, an application point of view, is not as straightforward as the D7 or the D8.
Okay. So in that situation you were talking about before, where the person was applying for the D8, they had everything correct, but had a rejection, you were able to fight their
They
case
didn't
for
have a rejection. They have a proposal for rejection. So, yes, and we had the opportunity to do allegations to present our arguments, and they were proved.
That would be
There
harder.
Was never a rejection. It was a, there was a proposal for rejection because of a little document, because there was no labor contract. But the truth is, in Portugal and in the States, it's not mandatory to have a written labor contract.
Okay. I'm just wondering if it was easier for you to fight the case for that person because it was a D8 compared to, say, the D2.
Yes, it was easier because in the D2 they have discretionary power, so it's subjective criteria that it's much more difficult to fight than the formal criteria, if you know them very well. And if you are familiar with administrative law, this is something that is common to administrative law. So it's your right, according to the constitution, that whenever there's a negative decision that will affect you, you always, and affects you directly, affects your personal sphere legally, you are entitled to present allegations, to present your arguments in that respect. This is a common rule of administrative law.
Okay. And it does sound like that is quite complicated, though, for an individual to do, and something that would be best handled by your team. So I'm going to share your email address with everybody in just a second, so that
Thank you,
anyone who
Jen.
does want to get in touch
Yes.
with you can do so.
Thank you so much.
But while I put that in the chat, I was going to ask about applying as a couple. Is it best to put the two people on one application? Should they have separate applications? Is there a sort of a thing that works best?
So I think it depends. If a couple is married for a long time, there is no big difference in doing it together, as an accompanying family member, but if you have the means, you can also do two independent visas. There is not a big difference in the two possibilities.
And if you did two independent visas, could you show that you are married to the other person, and that would influence the situation if one person was successful?
Yes, it might, but you have to show the independent financial requirements, the financial requirements independently for each person. So each would have to show that on average they earn 3,280 euros monthly. So it's a different financial requirement than if you're are coming as with a family reunification or accompanying family member. In those cases, it's 3,280 plus 50%.
Okay.
If this is two separate visas, the amount doubles.
The amount doubles.
If it is a family reunification, it's this amount plus 50%.
I see. So then you come in on your visa, and I understand it's granted for sort of maybe you can tell the times for this, but two years normally, or is it 2 to 3 years?
Two years
Okay.
after you receive the resident permit card.
And then there's a renewal. Is
Yes.
this basically the same as the first interview with
No,
IMA?
it's simpler. They just
Okay.
confirm that you still meet the requirements. It's simpler,
Okay.
it's not as complicated. And you can do it in Portugal. You don't have to go to your home country or country of citizenship or legal residency.
And is that something that your firm is able to help people with as well?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Now we've got one person who moved to Portugal on the D7 visa when it was also accepting digital nomads. And so this person only needed to show an income of around 800 euros per month. They're coming up for renewal now, and now there's this new digital nomad visa, and they're wondering, will they still need to show 820, or now will they need to show 3,280?
This is a tricky question. This is
Okay.
a little bit of a gray area. But I would say, in terms of legitimate expectancies, that you should be able to stay with the same financial requirements, because this is what was initially requested, and you made your legal regime decisions based on what you knew and what was the regime when you initiated the process. So I think this should be accepted, and there are arguments to defend this. But I don't have any experience with a similar case, so I don't know exactly how the authorities will react. But I think if I received a client with a project for denial, I could imagine myself presenting arguments and legitimate and strong argumentation, and I could imagine myself appealing successfully in such a case, but I would have to analyze it in very well.
Okay,
Concrete situation.
it does sound like a situation where the discretionary powers could come into play, and again, you need the services of someone like yourself to
Yes,
fight for you.
or a lawyer, someone that does understand the law and has experience with administrative law.
Okay, so the next couple of questions I have are all about couples where one person is an EU citizen and the other one isn't. They're a little bit complicated, so I will do my best to explain them. So feel free to ask me if
Yes,
you
yes.
need to clarify. So the first question is, there's a couple. One's, let's say, one's French and one's from the US. The French person can move to Portugal, and they have to register after 90 days at the local council, the Câmara Municipal. However, the non-EU citizen, their Schengen visa only allows them to come to Portugal 90 days anyway. And then they're supposed to register after their partner has registered with the local council. How does this work? Because are they illegal at this point?
First, what I can tell you is, some city councils do allow you to register before the end of the 3 months.
Okay.
So in such place, this would be our first strategy, to try to register the European citizen before the 3 months time, which we were able to do in several cases. And after that, you would start a family reunification process. And once you start the process and or do the attempts to do it, and if you cannot do it because of the IMA doesn't give you an appointment, then I think it's possible to defend that you're not illegally here.
Okay.
Because according to the law, as a family member of an European citizen, you are entitled to live here without needing an independent visa.
Now,
Yeah.
let's
And
say.
there are also something that don't want to be I don't want to be responsible for this affirmation, but what we have been seeing from a practical point of view is normally the authorities do allow that people stay up to 120 days without major problems. That doesn't mean that in the future this will remain the same.
Okay, so there hopefully is a little bit of leeway there, but you have recommendations to try and avoid things just in case.
Yes.
Now let's say that we'll take this couple again, one person from France, one person from the US. Let's say
we have several, we have several clients in this situation.
Okay.
He's French and she's from the US. At least two we have in this situation.
Interesting. It
yes.
seems yeah, it does seem complex. So let's say the French person moves to Portugal and the American is maybe still working in the US and plans to move in a year or two, but is maintaining residency in the US. Are they still limited by the 90 and 180 day Schengen rule if they want to come, say, to Portugal for 4 months to visit their partner?
I would say yes.
Okay.
And till they have their situation, their family reunification sorted, yes.
And then just going back to, let's suppose that these people weren't moving to Portugal, they were just traveling here. The European person, the French person can stay longer. What about the American? Can this person stay longer than 90 days on the basis that they're married to a European citizen?
No,
Okay.
he has to do a family reunification process. He
Okay.
has to start a procedure.
Okay. Now, I did have a couple more interesting questions come through. One was about one that actually comes through a couple of times is about minor criminal records that people might have, such as maybe getting a something related to their driving license or something like that. How does this affect them moving to Portugal? Does it need to be 100% perfectly spotless?
No, no. And in Europe, there you have the right of have some things forgotten and forgiven. So
Okay.
after some times, minor things that you did long time ago are erased from your criminal record in Portugal, which is not the case in the States. So, but these minor delicts, they are not considered for, according to our law, for this purpose and for a visa purpose. So,
Okay.
but it's important to address things properly and to explain that properly in the personal statement. We had several clients in this situation and they were rejected by some lawyers and some relocation companies, but we managed to explain their situation and to present it in an empathetical, both empathetical and with the legal roundings. And with several clients with minor things, we also compared how these things would be treated according to Portuguese law. So, and these persons had their visas approved.
Okay, interesting. Again, though, it does sound like something that people need the services of a lawyer to help them with that.
Because in the end, it's very important how you portray things and also the groundings that you present, also according to what are the rules of the Portuguese law for this, because there are specific rules for this.
So the rules are based on Portuguese law rather than the law
Yes.
of the country they're applying from.
Yes, because the D7 visa is subject to the Portuguese law. So also it only, they only take into account crimes that have 1 year prison or something like that. So it has this all visa procedures follows Portuguese law and for
Okay.
Portuguese law only.
I guess that makes sense. So then I was going to ask for those coming from Brazil or the other Portuguese speaking countries, are there other routes that are open to them to move to Portugal?
Yes, there were a CPLP visa, PALOP
Okay.
visa, but this was basically created. We don't have much clients in this situation, so we are not that familiar with this visa, but this was created to treat basically the situation of all those that were illegal here, and it was to legalize their situation, and they had 1 year of protection in respect to their situation.
Okay.
So this is the possible rule, but it's not working. We do have several people that approach us with several complaints about the way this visa works.
Okay. Now we've got a few people that are non-EU citizens, and they're, let's say again, they're someone from the US and they're living in an EU country like Spain. They've decided that Portugal is better. Perhaps they have listened to some of your previous talks on how great Portugal is.
Yours.
Yes, they might have read Portugalist. Now they
No,
want
no,
to.
perhaps no, perhaps they heard me because I'm always super optimistic about Portugal, and you sometimes say six reasons why you should leave Portugal, six reasons why you're leaving. So probably they heard me.
If they want to move to Portugal, do they apply? Let's say they're living in Spain. Would they apply in Spain, or would they go back to the country of their citizenship? In this example, the US.
They have the possibility to choose their
Okay.
country of citizenship or nationality, or the country of legal residency for over 1 year. So
Okay.
they can choose between one or the other. They can try to see which one works better and try to initiate the application in the country of citizenship or legal residency.
And do you think the fact that they've already lived in, let's say, Spain, for example, for a number of years would help them, given the fact that they've lived in the EU and they show a commitment to live in this part of the world?
I think yes, although there is nothing written about this, I think the authorities also want to analyze if a person will integrate easily in Portugal and with our, so a person that already lived in the European Union, especially in Spain, they show that they are already acquainted to some European and Iberian rules, which make much easier for them to integrate in the Portuguese community.
Okay.
Would say this is a favorable aspect, although there's nothing written about this.
There's nothing written. Okay, so it might come down to those discretionary powers again.
Yes.
There was a question then about a volunteer visa, whether someone could maybe work for a charity unpaid and move to Portugal that way.
Yes, this is very similar. It enters the category of student visa. It's a
Okay.
D4. So you have to present the same things that you would have for a student visa. The thing you have to show a document of the volunteer work you will do. You have to show that you will do volunteer work for over 1 year. And there are several platforms for volunteer work that provide this possibility.
Okay. I think we're getting towards the end of some of the questions that have previously been asked, Sandra. So thank you so much for covering all of those. I can take a look at some of the other questions, which I know your team have been answering. Actually, I can see they've already answered more than 100 while we've been talking. So that is very impressive.
This is a powerful team, yes.
Yes, it really is. So let's see. One question there, which and we haven't discussed these beforehand, so I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, Sandra. So do tell me if they're ones you aren't able to answer.
Yes, if I'm not able, I can come back. Or if this is a question for anyone, they can contact me and we will try to answer. Yes.
Firstly, could I also work in Portugal on the D8 visa?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
You can work, you can own a company, you can work, own property without any type of restriction. Yes, you can.
Now, understand that you have a period of around 12 months to import your personal household belongings into Portugal once you
Yes.
move here. Could you sort of explain a little bit about how that works in practice?
This is also an aspect that's important to have a legal help because you need to have a luggage certificate. Otherwise, you might end up having to pay import tax for your own stuff. So it's important when you have your visa and when it's approved that you take care of a luggage certificate, because you are entitled, if you're moving to a country, you are entitled to bring your things, your furniture, your things, the basic things for you to live without paying import taxes.
Okay. And actually, I noticed there's a clarification on that. The person was asking whether they could work on the D7 visa, but I believe you answered that, but maybe it's worth repeating.
Yes, I already answered that.
Now, let's see if we've got another question. So while you're waiting, let's say you've been granted or you have had your IMA appointment, you're waiting for the residence permit. Are there any restrictions on whether you have to stay in Portugal during that time?
You should stay in Portugal during that time. So
Okay.
You have, once you have the 4 months visa stamped on your passport, you can leave the country for twice.
Okay.
And you should not do it. And you if the 4 months of the visa are already gone, you should stay in Portugal before you receive the resident permit card. Although I already have clients that said, you said I should stay, but I didn't stay, and there was no problem. So I'm always a little bit legalist and a little bit
Sure.
cautious in terms of the rules and how clients should behave.
And then going back to sort of importing your own belongings, do you what would you say to someone who's thinking about bringing a car into Portugal?
The legalization is always a little bit troublesome, and you do have to pay taxes. So this would be, I would always say, do you really want, it's really important for you. Otherwise, I think it might make sense if you take into account transportation, the formalities, the taxes. It might be better to buy some used car here, unless this is really something important for you.
I think there's
It
some
depends on the case. It depends on the criteria of a person, but it has taxes, formalities, cost of transportation. There are several aspects that have to be taken into account.
I think there's some practical elements as well. If you're coming from the UK or Ireland, the steering wheel is on the other side. If you're coming
Yeah,
from
so
yes.
this is a nightmare. Yes, then it will be, yes.
In the
You better
US
not
as well.
drive unless you are
Yeah.
very, your brain works very well.
It is complicated switching between the two. The other thing is cars in the US are much larger than the ones here, and the streets in Portugal in some towns can be very, very narrow,
You
and parking
cannot
spaces are small.
be in Lisbon in those crazy streets in Alfa
No.
with the American car, no.
Let's see what else we have. And then one visa we haven't really touched on too much is the golden visa, and I did
Yes.
see a question come through about that. In terms of moving to Portugal, do you that obviously suits some people, but in general, do you think that the D7 and D8 are better routes for people?
Yes, I think the golden visa is a good option when people want to have a second possibility, but they are not in condition to reside in Portugal, because the D7 and the D8 by themselves do not require any investment, whereas the standard investment of the golden visa is 500,000 euros. Also, the procedure of the golden visa is taking much longer than a D7 or a D8. So if a person is not in the conditions to move to Portugal, but wants to create this possibility to live in Europe, to reside in Europe, to have an alternative if they don't feel safe in their own country, if they think it's really important to have a second option, but they are not in the conditions or do not want to reside in Portugal, for those, I think the golden visa might be a good option. For all those that are in the conditions to move to Portugal, we try to orient them always for the D7 or the D8, because it's not worth to do a 500,000 investment when you can do it without an investment.
Okay. Next.
It's important to clarify that after so many contradictory informations that the golden visa is live and kicking, although real estate investment or real estate related funds are excluded from the golden visa, it's possible to invest in Portugal in the golden visa through funds, investment in a company, creating jobs, scientific research, investment in culture. So there are possibilities. The golden visa is live and kicking, which for some people, there was so many misinformation, and it was so spread that the golden visa ended, and that it's also important to clarify that.
Okay. Now, in terms of sort of coming up with a strategy for moving to Portugal, let's say I am in the US, I have all my documentation ready, but I'm trying to work out when am I going to be able to move to Portugal? Is it a case that I will show a ticket, a flight ticket of when I plan to go, and I will know the exact date that I can go, or am I going to have a window of time in which I can go?
Can you clarify your question? It was not clear what you wanted to ask.
Sure, I'll try and explain it better. So some people are wondering about, they're going to have to attend an interview with the consulate, and then they're going to get a 4 month period
visa
at some point. They're trying to work out, how do you plan for that? Like, do you sort of...
So the norm is you would have, after having the personal appointment in the consulate, it varies, but within 15 days to 2 months, with standard time, 1 month, you get the your passport stamped.
Okay.
And then you have the 4 months. So I would say you put something like 5 months for the return ticket. But I always, always advise people to have a refundable ticket.
Okay.
And a flexible ticket that allows you to change dates.
Okay. That's
although it's more expensive, I think it's safer.
I think it's a very good idea.
Yes.
And can you speak a little bit about exchanging driving licenses, or is that something for another webinar?
No, it's not something for another webinar. Recently, the Portuguese government issued a law 1 year or 1 year and a half, issued a law that recognized most of the driving license from the US, Canada, from many countries. So the driving license is valid. After some time of driving in Portugal, you have to do some formality, but it's not a big thing because the driving license is valid here.
Okay.
You have to register somewhere. It's not something I do personally. Someone in my office does it. But I know the driving license is recognized here, most of them. And it's just a register thing. It's a bureaucratic thing, but it's not a great deal.
Okay.
You don't have to do a different test. You don't have to test again. Or do
Okay,
it.
That is good to know. I'm not sure I would pass again.
None of us after so many years. Yes.
Yeah, you develop a few bad habits over time. There's a few questions then about what counts as accommodation, let's say for the D7 or D8. Some people are wondering, could you have something like a camper van? Could you stay in an Airbnb? Would either of those two things work?
I think that we already knew of cases that were not accepted because of this. So I would never advise that. Although if a person really, really wants, we can try to talk to a specific consulate and to understand if it's acceptable. But initially, some years ago, that was not a problem at all. In recent years, the consular authorities are quite demanding in terms of the proof of accommodation.
Okay, so that is much more serious. I think I'm noticing that quite a few of the questions that are left are specific. So what I think maybe they're best for your team to answer and directly with the people that have asked them.
Yes, of course.
We
If
can.
there's anyone that has an unanswered questions, they can also always reach out to us. And I think perhaps we are full of work. So I would say that perhaps for the 30 people that contact us and mention Portugalist plus SGP Sandra Gomes Pinto, we
Okay.
can give a 15-minute free call, free Zoom call. I think
Okay.
this is we can also do.
So you are in the first 30 people. I've just put the code in the chat. You will get a free 15-minute call from Sandra and her team. I think that is a very good reason to get in touch. I know that you will have a lot of inquiries after this webinar. So if people are serious about moving to Portugal, it's very important that they do get in touch with you.
Yes, and I think both from a legal and also relocation point of view, preparation has a huge impact on having the proper relocation. We had some clients that go with the flow and they decided the place everybody was talking about, but then they had serious health issues. And when something complicated arises, they understood that that was not the best place to be. So it's better to address things with time, with anticipation, to think about what you want, what are you looking for, your expectations, what are your non-negotiables. So both from a legal and a relocation point of view, preparation is everything. And in the case of, in our case, perhaps in terms of Portuguese bureaucracy, the more you prepare, the better prepared you are, the better it is.
Okay. And would you recommend that people come to Portugal to sort of visit it first, perhaps spend some time before moving here?
Yes, I recommend. But I think people also should prepare these scouting trips and should know exactly where they would look for, where they would go, because it's difficult to go throughout all Portugal. So they
Yeah.
could try to see three or four places that they really think that might they might like to live in, and then you should visit and prepare a scouting trip concentrated in these places.
Okay, that's really good advice. You don't want to sort of do it like
Yes.
you're traveling where you do a day or two in each place. It's really getting a good feel for it. Well, Sandra, I really want to thank you for this webinar. It has been really, really helpful and insightful. I'm looking, there's 146 questions answered. I don't know if that's our record or not, but it seems like a very, very high number.
Yes, it's a high. This team is, and you cannot stop them. It's unstoppable. Yes, this powerful team. Yeah, yes.
Well,
We have Alexander Paciência, which is great,
mm-hmm.
and we have Ineida, our powerhouse. I think she, when she starts writing, nobody stops her.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm going to share this, a copy of this recording with everybody, and also more information about getting in touch with you if they don't already have that.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's always a big pleasure for us to work and to collaborate with you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.